The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Shadate Hargett Hill from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, edition February 12th. The best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Keir for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to her family. We begin the issue with the main stories. Cruz's victory over Trump scrambles GOP. What happened? Texas Senator Ted Cruz's surprise win over Donald Trump in the Iowa caucus this week punctured the GOP frontrunner's aura of invincibility, and along with the Florida Senator Marco Rubio's unexpectedly strong third-place finish, significantly altered the Republican presidential race going into next week's New Hampshire primary. With a record 185,000 Republican voters, Cruz, a religious conservative who enjoys strong backing from those in 28% of the vote to Trump's 24%, Rubio, who may have established Republicans considered to be their best hope in a general election, finished with 23%, about 6 points higher than the pre-caucus polling. None of the other candidates made it into double digits. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, and former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum later ended their campaigns. Tonight's a victory for the grassroots, said Cruz. Iowa has sent notice that the Republican nominee will not be chosen by the media, will not be chosen by the Washington establishment, will not be chosen by the lobbyists. Trump initially said he was honored to finish second, but later claimed that Cruz's campaign stole Iowa by the erroneous telling of people that rival candidate Ben Carson was dropping out of the race. As the focus shifts to New Hampshire, where Trump enjoyed a 20-point lead before the Iowa caucus, the establishment candidates trained their fire on one another, each hoping to emerge as the sole mainstream alternative to Trump and Cruz. Former Florida Gov. Jeff Bush told Hall Call meeting at the near Rubio Foundation, he told those people near Cruz, both first-term senators, had the life experience to be president, nor did they know what they were doing. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie mocked Rubio for his tightly controlled campaign appearances. This isn't a student council election, he said. Let's get the boy in the bubble out of the bubble. The candidates will face off in a final televised debate on Saturday, February 6th, before the primary on Tuesday. What the editorial said. The American political revolution appears to be exaggerated, said the Wall Street Journal. After months of bombast and bluster, Trump couldn't convert his large crowds and poll leads into what matters, votes. While Cruz ran a well-organized campaign, visiting all 99 of Iowa's counties, and investing heavily in voter analytics, his arrogant rival assumed his celebrity status and media attention would see him through, even boycotting the debate held on the eve of the caucus. How would this self-proclaimed winner respond to the uncomfortable reality of second place? Who knows? Cruz remains a problematic presidential nominee, said the Los Angeles Times. He is just as extreme as Trump on issues like immigration and has been a champion of partisan paralysis. In the Washington era, refusing to negotiate with Democrats and orchestrating the needles government shutdown of 2013. Indeed, polls show he may even be more vulnerable than Trump in November's general election. But Cruz did the country a favor by winning Iowa. Had Trump won, his campaign could easily have become a runaway train. Responsible Republicans will be encouraged by Marco Rubio's strong showing, said the New York Daily News. The smooth-talking Florida senator isn't a moderate by any stretch, but he has an impressive command of foreign policy and his work on bipartisan immigration reform, though considerate is among the conservatives, showed a willingness to work with his political opponents. To have any chance of stopping Trump and Cruz, the establishment must be cohesive around a single candidate. Rubio is the clear alternative to the bomb throwers. What the columnist said, Cruz's win affirmed that the laws of American politics have not yet been rewritten, said John Pohorts in the New York Post. Trump's high poll numbers never reflected the undeniable high negatives in favorability ratings. Rather than mobilizing to the vote for his reality TV huckster, Republicans came out in force to tell him to take a well-deserved hike. Trump's not dead yet, said Raheem Salim in Slate.com. He spent relatively little time on money in Iowa, knowing its strong evangelical population would also favor Cruz. Trump appeals not only to most working class Republicans in rural stretches of the Deep South, he also represents the Northeast. A few more ego-bruising reversals may well make him more likely make him interested in his foray in politics. But as long as Trump wants to pursue the nomination, he will remain a formidable force. The Iowa results suggest that Republicans will eventually make the right choice, said Jason Riley in the Wall Street Journal. Exit polls show that Rubio did particularly well among voters who valued electability above all other traits. They've got the right idea. Trump and Cruz may be popular among conservatives, but they both fare worse than Rubio in head-to-head matchups with Hillary Clinton in the key swing states. The Florida senator is also more popular among white women, seniors, and independents, and his attempt to enact immigration reforms puts him in a better position to make inroads with Hispanics. Trump and Cruz want to deepen the GOP's appeal. Rubio wants to widen it. Iowa didn't decide anything, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. All it did was confirm the theory that there are three lanes in the GOP race. Cruz has firm control of the religious conservative lane. Trump holds the outside lane. Rubio takes it to task to make the establishment lane his own. That won't be easy in New Hampshire, said Matt Mawaska in TheHill.com. Christie has spent more time in the Granite State than any other candidate. Ohio Governor John Kast has won 7 of the state's 8 newspaper endorsements, and Jeb Bush's popularity is much stronger than there is in Iowa. Rubio needs to finish ahead of all three. Even after just one vote, the contours of the GOP race are coming into focus. And how they were covered? Clinton and Sanders prepare for a long fight. What happened? Democrats were bracing for a protracted battle for the party's presidential nomination after Hillary Clinton this week eked out a razor-thin victory over Bernie Sanders in the Iowa caucus. And the candidates moved on to New Hampshire for the February 9th primary. It was the Democrats' closest ever contest in Iowa, with Clinton winning 49.9% of state delegates to the Vermont senators' 49.6%. Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley finished a distant third and dropped out of the race. Clinton held a 30-point lead among Iowans 3 months ago, but seemed relieved to end with a hairbreadth triumph in the Hawkeye State, where in 2008 she finished third behind then-Senator Barack Obama and John Edwards. I am so thrilled that I am coming to New Hampshire after winning Ohio, the former Secretary of State told supporters in New Hampshire. I've won and lost there. It's a lot better to win. Sanders, a self-proclaimed Democrat socialist who has galvanized the left with calls from a political revolution, dominated Clinton among younger Iowa Democrats, scoring a 70-point advantage among 18 to 29-year-olds. The people of Iowa have sent a very profound message, Sanders said. It's just too late for establishment politics and establishment economics. The senator holds a 33-point lead in New Hampshire, a University of Massachusetts poll found, and while Clinton remains a heavy favorite to amass the delegates needed for the nomination, Her camp isn't underestimating Sanders. In my view, said Clinton advisor Harry Eakes, he could run this right down to the convention. What the editorial said, Iowa was an eye-opener, offering insight into the hearts and minds of America's youth, said CSMonitor.com. Sanders' resounding performance among younger voters revealed a long trust in institutions among the new generation. His talk of revolution resonates with many Americans under 30 who, according to a recent survey, disdain Congress and the media and seem to be on a free-floating search for a wholly new consensus on politics and the economy. Clinton's in big trouble, said the Washington Examiner. She blew an enormous lead in Iowa against an elderly extremist. And although President Obama carried the state twice, polls show her trailing Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio there. But her problems go much deeper than her political opponents. The real issue is Clinton's tenuous relationship with the truth. Confronted with her careless handling of classified emails, for example, she has repeatedly offered false explanations. Clinton may win the nomination, but her supporters have good reason to be unenthusiastic. What the columnist said? A tie in Iowa is a win for Hillary, said Peter Barnard, TheAtlantic.com. That's because, demographically, the Hawkeye state was her worst nightmare. Dominated by white liberals, Clinton's weakest constituency, going forward, Hillary has a big edge in blue-collar states like Pennsylvania, where white Democrats are more moderate, and in states with large African-American populations like South Carolina. She may not have inspired Iowa Democrats like Bernie did, but she played him even and lived to fight another day on more hospitable terrain. Clinton should have trounced Sanders, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Why didn't she? Elections are about the future, and so much about Clinton screams the past. At her rally, she seems the battle-weary survivor. Her language evokes drudgery and duty rather than inspiration, and she can sound as if she's collecting an eye on you. Clinton's best hope now is to grind out a victory over many months, said Jonah Goldberg in USTODAY.com. She'll inevitably alienate Sanders supporters, who are exactly the kind of young activists Clinton desperately needs to win in November. For the Democratic Party, this is the worst of all possible outcomes. Actually, the Sanders-Clinton rivalry is energizing the party, said Jamil Bowie in Slate.com. Iowa hasn't changed the basic shape of the race. Clinton is still the favorite, and for Sanders to win, he has to excel, or she needs to stumble badly. Yes, it will be a long haul. That sounds weary to anyone who remembered the 2008 primaries, but Democrats should relish the combat. A truly competitive race will fire up the base and prime the party and its candidates for a tough and grueling general election. Controversy of the week, Republicans. Can the party harness its Trump appeal? Donald Trump may have finished second in Iowa, said Victor Davis Hanson and NationalReview.com, but it would be foolish for Republicans now to write him off as a great historical footnote. Instead, GOP elites should listen to and learn from Trump voters and try to figure out and learn why millions of conservatives and blue-collar workers are so enthusiastic about a vulgar narcissist, former reality TV host, and Manhattanized former Democrat. Trump has dominated a Republican race and horrified the party establishment by bluntly and impolitely addressing voters' fears about illegal immigration, Islamic terrorists, and America's shrinking stature on the world stage. This is what Pat Buchanan called the conservatism of the heart, not Washington think tanks. The Republican mainstream hopes Marco Rubio's strong showing in Iowa means voters are coming to their senses, said Peter Barnard in TheAtlantic.com. But Rubio's poll, census, numbers, only picked up when the drop when he dropped his moderate wokish persona only and stated making angry Trump-like promises to close the borders, oppose free trade, and ban Muslim refugees from entering the country. Trump may have lost in Iowa, but Trumpism won. The Donald's popularity is a direct reaction to the intellectual corruption of the Republican Party, said Tucker Carlson in Politico.com. For 40 years, the white working class have watched their jobs disappear overseas or get taken by immigrants. Circleism, multiculturalism, and political correctness having transformed America into a place where conservatives are routinely demonized as bigots or ridiculed as ignorant gun-wielding rubes. Republican candidates have won many elections by tapping into the resentments of the forgotten working class. Once elected, however, most invariably turn their attention back to doing favors for their corporate and wealthy individual donors. And voters are sick of it. In Trump, for all his flaws, they see someone who's going to fight for them. And if he's less polished and more outrageous than a traditional politician, so much the better. It turns out that GOP wasn't simply out of touch with its voters. The party had no idea who its voters were or what they believed. But make no mistake, there's an ominous aspect to Trump's appeal, said Max Efradom in WashingtonPost.com. New research has found that what most Trump fans have in common is an authoritarian personality, an intolerance for ambiguity and difference, and an eagerness to see minorities and outsiders put in their place. Trumpists are as taken with the alpha male strongman personality as they are with his disdain for the party establishment. This is bad news for the other contenders in the GOP primary, who simply don't project the same kind of strength. Trump is far too extreme on many issues and shouldn't be nominated, said Ramesh Pomara and Rich Laurie and NationalReview.com. But Republicans can't simply reject Trump's followers. Instead, we should try to absorb them and moderate his message the same way we did with the followers of Barry Goldwater and George Wallace. For decades, the GOP establishment and its presidential candidates have been preaching the gospel of free trade, small government, and lower taxes for the rich as the primary drivers of prosperity. What Trump has figured out is that when push comes to shove, voters care more about the national strength, jobs, and their own economic benefits than the relative abstractions of supply side and the blueprint of what they call a new conservative populism. The U.S. at a glance. In San Francisco, police probe. The Justice Department opened an investigation this week into the San Francisco Police Department 2 months after officers fatally shot a young African-American man, sparking protests in the city. In a bystander's video of the shooting that went viral, officers were seen surrounding Mario Woods, 26, as he stood against a wall holding a knife. Woods, who suffered from mental illness, then moved toward an officer and prompted police to open fire. The police department said Woods matched the description of a suspect wanted for a stabbing and that they had shot bean bags and pepper spray to try to subdue him before opening fire. Hundreds of demonstrators took to the streets to protest the officer's alleged attack and abuse of excessive force after the video was released in December. The Justice Department will investigate the police department's training operations, use of force, and accountability. Flint, Michigan. Lead poisoning. Flint Mayor Karen Weaver demanded this week that all lead pipes be immediately removed from the city's water system, starting with the homes of pregnant women and young children, in a bid to fix an ongoing crisis over contaminated drinking water. Weaver immediately faced questions on how her plan would be funded, though Lansing Mayor Virg Bernero pledged assistance from his city's Board of Water and Light. Flint's 100,000 residents have been forced to use bottled water to cook and clean, ever since it emerged that their water had been poisoned by lead after emergency managers switched the city's supply to the Flint River in April 2014. The FBI has joined a criminal investigation into the contamination, saying it would examine whether any laws had been broken during the switch and after, when officials assured residents who complained of health issues that the water was perfectly safe. In New York, top secret info. The State Department announced last week that it will not release 22 emails from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's private server because the messages contain top secret information, the highest level of government classification. The agency has been gradually releasing the emails as part of a Freedom of Information request. The FBI is also investigating Clinton's use of the private server set up in her home to see if it led to any government secrets being compromised during her time as Secretary of State. Clinton maintains that she never sent any information that was marked classified over the server, and the State Department said that the statutes of the 22 emails were only recently upgraded at the request of an intelligence community. A separate review is underway by two divisions within the State Department to see whether the messages should have been considered classified at the time. Los Angeles inmates captured. The manhunt for three fugitive Orange County inmates ended this week after two of the escapees had a fight over whether to kill a taxi driver they had kidnapped, authorities said, leading one of the men to turn himself in. Hassan Nareri, 37, Bach Duong, 43, and Jonathan Tiu, 20, allegedly kidnapped the driver after their audacious escape from the Orange County Central Men's Jail, which involved them sawing through steel bars and rappelling down the side of the building. The trio forced the driver to take them to a salon where they tried to change their appearance, and then to a San Jose motel. Najari then suggested killing the driver, authorities said, but Duong objected. The pair fought, and Duong ordered the driver to take him back to jail. Nareri and TR were arrested hours later. Tallahassee executions in doubt. Florida Supreme Court this week called off the execution of a convicted murderer days before he was to be put to death, amid an ongoing debate over whether a U.S. Supreme Court ruling effectively spares all 389 inmates on the state's death row. Last month, a U.S. Supreme Court declared Florida's death penalty statute unconstitutional, ruling that only juries, not judges, had the right to impose the sentence. The Florida justice declined to say whether Carrie Michael Labreck's execution would go forward or whether the top court's decision would retroactively apply to the state's death row inmates, a scenario Florida's assistant attorney general said would be catastrophic for the state and for victims. In the meantime, at least one Florida judge has ruled that prosecutors in an upcoming murder case can't seek a death sentence, concluding there is currently no existing death penalty in the state of Florida. Baltimore, inaugural mosque visit. President Obama forcefully rebuked the rise of inexcusable political rhetoric against Muslims as he made his first presidential visit to an American mosque this week, meeting with Muslim opportunity leaders at the Islamic Society of Baltimore. In a speech, Obama implicitly attacked the policy proposal of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, who has called for a ban on Muslims entering the country, saying that the entire Muslim community was being blamed for the violent acts of the very few. In such an environment, Obama said, it's no surprise that threats and harassment of Muslim Americans have surged. Hate crimes against Muslim businesses and mosques tripled in 2015. According to a recent study, nearly half of Americans think at least some U.S. Muslims are anti-American, according to polls, while 43% of Republicans believe Obama is Muslim. We move now to Only in America. A Minnesota school has banned Valentine's Day, Christmas, and other dominant holidays to prevent students of cultures from feeling left out. Celebrating the holidays in a school with many immigrants is threatening the culture of tolerance and respect for all, said Bruno Vinto, elementary school principal Scott Massini. Many parents responded with an anger and with all one calling for policies nuts. An Indiana lawmaker is refusing to back civil rights protections for gays and lesbians because there are no similar laws protecting fat white people. State Republican Woody Burton called homosexuality a behavioral thing, not overwhelming, and argued, if I pass a law that says transgenders and homosexuals are covered under the civil rights laws, does it say anyone that's fat and white are covered? Good week for organic defenses. After Dutch police began testing the use of trained eagles to catch and destroy illegal drones, it's a low-tech trained eagle to catch other low-tech solutions to a high-tech problem, said police spokesman. A taste of his own medicine. After a Miami motorist flagged down and pulled over a local police officer to tell him he was speeding, I pushed 80 to try to catch up to you, and I was still eating your dust, Claudia Costello told the cop. I'll be sure to slow down next time, ma'am, the cop responded. Frankfurters. After a U.S. startup specializing in test tube meats unveiled its first lab-ground meatball. This is the future of meat, said Uma Valtini, CEO of Memphis Meats. She says, we plan to do a lot to the meat industry. We plan to do to the meat industry what the car did to the horse and buggy. Bad week for dropping anchor. After the anchor chain on the luxury yacht owned by a Microsoft co-founder, Paul Allen, accidentally destroyed a large swath of protected coral reef near the Cayman Islands. A renowned conservatist, the multi-billionaire is facing up to $600,000 in fines. Trolling after officials at the Nobel Institute revealed that Donald Trump has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. An anonymous U.S. politician submitted Trump's name, and the Institute stated it accepts all nominations. British movie censors, who had to sit through a 10-hour film, consisted of a single shot of white paint drying on a wall, a film made to protest the UK's rating laws. The censors rated it suitable for viewers aged 4 and over. Boring but important. Cancer moonshot funding proposed. The White House announced this week that it plans to spend nearly $1 billion to fund President Obama's promise of a moonshot to cure cancer. The initiative, which will be led by Vice President Joe Biden, will devote $195 million in new cancer-related funding to the National Institutes of Health in the current fiscal year. The administration will ask Congress for another $755 million in its budget for the 2017 fiscal year. Cancer researchers welcome the extra funds, though many express doubts that Biden would have the time or money to come close to a cure before leaving office in 2017. We're not going to the moon on $1 billion, said Peter Amson, chairman of the Children's Oncology Group, which conducts national clinical trials. And noted, in a poll to test voters' ability to recognize presidential candidates, more people could identify Ted Cruz, 61%, Bernie Sanders, 69%, Jeb Bush, 77%, then New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady by 56%, Hillary Clinton, 97%, Donald Trump, 96%, topped the poll ahead of George Clooney, Bill Murray, and Justin Bieber. Despite his focus on Christianity, President candidate Ted Cruz and his banker wife donated less than 1% of their income to charity and nothing to churches, according to their tax returns from 2006 to 2010. Cruz said he'd been focused on building a solid financial foundation to provide for my children. Professional cycling has a new form of doping, mechanical doping. A tiny motor was found last weekend in a bike being used by female Belgium cyclist Femke van den Dreske at the Cyclocross World Championship in Belgium. Rumors of motor doping have swirled around the sport for years, but were largely dismissed as an urban legend. Facebook is replacing its like button with 6 reaction emojis: angry, sad, wow, haha, yay, and love. The social network's 1.6 billion users click on the like button more than 6 billion times a day, more frequently than people conducted searches on Google. And talking gossip, just hours after the death of her father, Vanessa Hudgens this week delivered a powerhouse performance as hard-boiled Rizzo in Fox's televised production of Grease Live. "I'm so sorry to say that last night my daddy, Greg, passed away from stage 4 cancer," Hudgens, 27, tweeted before the show, which drew some 12 million viewers. In classic Trooper tradition, the grieving actress then donned a black pencil skirt to join Julianne Hough, Aaron Trivette, and Carly Rae Jepsen in the show, based on the 1978 film version of the long-running Broadway musical. Hudgens won particularly high praises for her emotional rendition of Rizzo's song, "There Are Worse Things I Could Do," and dedicated the performance to her father's memory. "Imagine if you had a day like Vanessa Hudgens and performed like that," tweeted co-star Mario Lopez. "Wow, what a strong woman." A few weeks shy of her 50th birthday, Cindy Crawford is stepping away from the supermodel business. Known for her signature mold, Crawford vaulted to international celebrity in the late 80s and 90s and has remained a ubiquitous presence in magazines and commercials. But she has concluded it's time to move on. "I'm sure I have my picture taken for 10 more years, but not as a model anymore," Crawford said. "I shouldn't have to keep proving myself." Crawford later took back some of her words, saying she would never say never to be modeling again and might get back in front of the camera if she received an exciting offer. Chelsea Clinton revealed this week that at age 5, she wrote a letter to President Ronald Reagan, but to her disappointment, never received a reply. "I went to the mailbox literally every day for 2 months," she recalled. Clinton wrote to dissuade Reagan from his controversial 1985 visit to Germany's Bitburg Cemetery, resting place of numerous Nazi officials. "My letter said, 'Dear Mr. President, I've seen the Sound of Music. The Nazis don't look like very nice people,'" Clinton recalled. When her father, Bill, became president, she prodded him to launch the Children Correspondence Union, which ensures that youngsters who write to the White House receive personalized responses. The world at a glance. As we continue, we go to Russia. Politicians in the crosshairs. Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov posted a video on Instagram this week of two of Russia's most prominent opposition figures, Mikhail Jaskofanov and Vladimir Karamazov, filmed through a sniper's crosshairs. Kadyrov, a brutal warlord, is close to President Vladimir Putin, who allows him to maintain his own armed militia and run the Russian province of Chechnya as he pleases in exchange for keeping local insurgents under control. Many Russian opposition figures believe that Kadyrov was behind the murder last year of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. Kadyrov and Karamazov have been lobbying the European Union to open an investigation into Nemtsov's murder after Instagram deleted Khashoggi's video, the Chechen leader said he had been censored by U.S. hellhounds. In Tokyo, Amazon's Rent-A-Monk, Japanese Buddhists looking for a cheap monk to conduct a funeral or other ritual can now order one online. Amazon Japan offers monk delivery, packages that bring a freelance monk directly to a consumer to perform a ritual at a fraction of the fee that a temple would charge. Buddhist groups said the service was commercializing the sacred. "We must say we are disappointed by an attitude toward religion by Amazon," said Akasato Sato, director of Japan Buddhist Association. But monks who work on demand said they are serving those less well off. "There is no point being a monk," said Kachi Wanabe, "if we can't offer a helping hand when someone needs us." In China, nightmare commute. Tens of thousands of Chinese trying to get home for the Lunar New Year holidays were stranded by bad weather this week. Hundreds of millions of people traveled at this time of the year, many from migrant workers going from their jobs in the industrial region to their homes in the rural interior. Nearly 100,000 people got stuck at a train station when trains were canceled because of heavy snow in China's eastern and central provinces. But authorities have prepared for the throngs, dispatching large numbers of security officers and their stampedes. People in China would take nearly 3 billion train trips over the 40-day holiday season. Myanmar. Democratic era begins. After decades of military rule in Myanmar, Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy has taken the reins of government at last. The party won a landmark victory last November in the country's first democratic election in 25 years, and nearly one-third of its new members of parliament are former political prisoners like Suu Kyi. They celebrated their entrance to the legislature with singing and cheering. The military still retains some control, as the constitution it wrote gives it 25% of the seats in parliament, enough to veto constitutional changes. The document also bars Suu Kyi from becoming president because her two British-born sons are not Myanmar citizens. Suu Kyi says she will choose a proxy president and wield power behind the scenes. Somalia, plane explosion. A blast on a commercial plane over Somalia this week blew a hole in the full siege and sucked one passenger out to his death. The body of 55-year-old man was later found north of Bangladesh, Somalia. Officials say they weren't sure what caused the explosion, but U.S. government sources told Reuters it was probably a bomb. There was no immediate comment from Al-Shabaab, the jihadist group that has waged an insurgence against Somalia's Western-backed government. Following the blast, the cabin lost pressure and oxygen masks came down, but flight attendants calmed the passengers and the plane landed safely. It was my very first bomb, said pilot Vlaka Vlapikovich, who has decades of flight experience. I hope it will be the last. Awi Kunya, Somalia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations, was on board the Dalia Airlines flight from Mogadishu to Djibouti. In Jerusalem, Wali Wall opens up. The Israeli cabinet voted this week to establish a permanent space where women and non-Orthodox Jews can pray at the Western Wall, Judaism's holiest site. The new mixed-gender prayer space is on the wall's southern edge, separated from the main plaza prayer site. American rabbis and a group called Women of the Wall have been lobbying for the change for years, and in 2000, the government began allowing women to pray at the makeshift site nearby. Many Orthodox Jews are outraged. The blasphemy that this group and its supporters have penetrated is so horrendous that it would take years to fix, says Rabbi Shmuel Rabinovich. in people we move to? Baez for life. Joan Baez has known some of the most famous men of her time, said Barbara Hoffman in the New York Post. One of the icons of the 1960s protest movement, Baez marched with Martin Luther King Jr. in Mississippi, sang with Pete Seeger, and performed at and toured with her former lover, Bob Dylan. Now 75, Baez says she hasn't seen Dylan for decades. I don't expect anything of him, so I don't worry about it, says Baez. He gave us the greatest gift in the 60s, an arsenal of music to just listen to and enjoy or take into battle. That's way more than you can ask. Another notable ex-lover was Steve Jobs, whom Baez met in Palo Alto when she was a 41-year-old divorced mother and Jobs was 27. We didn't agree on anything. He'd say, I'm going to make a computer that won't just duplicate a Beethoven sonata. It will be better. And I'd like to say, excuse me, what about the soul? He'd say, it'll just be better. And I'd be dumbfounded. And then we'd grab dinner. Today, Baez lives alone. She still performs through her distinctive soprano singing voice, although her distinctive singing voice has changed over the years. In the beginning, it was one long, high note. Now it's deep. But it's a good voice. In a way, it's much more interesting now. It represents a full life. Reynolds' paternal ordeal. Ryan Reynolds is a very anxious new dad, said Eric Spanagle in Men's Health. The actor and his wife, Blake Lively, had their first child January 2015, and the experience has driven them both a little bit insane, says Reynolds. During those first 6 months, it's amazing that you find a way to keep going. Just the lack of sleep and the hallucinations. You want to trip balls, hallucinate, have a kid and see what it's like to be awake for a month straight. A year on, Reynolds still constantly worries about his daughter. I check on her in the middle of the night and put my fingers under her nose just to make sure she's still breathing. He sometimes wishes he could be more like his father, who died a few months ago after a long battle with Parkinson's disease. We had a deeply complicated relationship, Reynolds says, but his father showed him that there's something to be learned by taking life a little less seriously. In my dad's dying moments, we were making him laugh. We were all in there together, me and my brothers, just joking with him, busting each other's chops. Now, that for my father is tremendous. Now that my father is gone, he says, it leaves behind some questions that are still being answered, including how to get better at being a dad, a husband, and a man. Collins' road to recovery. Phil Collins is coming out of hiding, said Will Hodgson in the Times UK. The British music star fled to Switzerland in the late 1990s, partly to escape the constant abuse of the tabloid press, who regularly attacked him for his pop hits and his messy love life. I'm too sensitive, Collins says. He hit rock bottom a few years later after divorcing his third wife, Ariane. She took their two kids to live with her in Miami, and Collins, who was suffering from spinal cord damage caused by spending decades sitting on drum stools, couldn't even play music to distract himself. There was a massive hole in my heart and my life, which I filled with a lot of drinking, says Collins. At 11 in the morning, I would put the television on, watch the cricket, and open a bottle of wine. And then I would drink vodka, and that doesn't agree with your pancreas. Collins finally pulled himself together when he realized his kids were afraid he was going to die. Now I've given up, and family life is so much better, says Collins. Collins, who has moved back in with Orion and tentatively taken up music again. I've bought myself a piano, and I'm easily flattered. I went on a British Airways flight recently, and everyone was pleased to see me, and I thought, that was great. In briefing, addicted to lotteries? The nation was recently in a frenzy over a $1 billion Powerball jackpot. But are lotteries just a tax in disguise? What are the chances you'll win? Small. Ticket holders in the multi-state Powerball lottery, for example, have a 1 in 292,201,338 chance of winning the jackpot. That's like putting into a hat the names of nearly everyone in the U.S. and hoping your name is pulled out. Yet the fantasy of getting rich quick is too tempting for many of us to resist. About half of Americans have played the lottery at least once. With a growing array of prize drawings, electronic games, and scratch cards available, sales in the 43 state lotteries totaled $70 billion in 2014, or $300 per every American adult. More than was spent on video games, movie tickets, books, and sporting events combined. But there is a huge disparity in how much people spend. 54% of ticket sales come from 5% of players, who tend to be poor and uneducated. The hope of getting out of poverty encourages people to continue to buy tickets, says Emily Hasley, an expert in financial decision making. Buying lottery tickets exacerbates the very poverty that purchasers are hoping to escape. Where does the lottery money go? In most states, about 60% of ticket revenue goes to the jackpot, and the winners generally must surrender more than 40% of the prize money to federal, state, and local income taxes. Of the remaining revenues, the lottery company takes a small share. So too do the ticket retailers. The rest, typically about 25 to 30%, goes into the state's coffers. State officials like to tell the public that lottery revenues are plowed into education. But the reality is that the state governments use lottery proceeds not to increase what they spend on schools and teachers, but as an additional funding source for their overall budgets. The money that would have been spent on education had there been no lottery cash is simply spent on other things. In fact, the few states that don't have lotteries spend on average 10% more of their budgets on education. That's why critics say the lottery is a shell game and a tax on stupidity, and all a regressive tax at that. Why is it regressive? Because the poor and less educated spend a much larger proportion of their income on tickets than the rich. A 1999 Duke University study found that people with household incomes below $25,000 spend an average of $583 a year on lottery, compared with just $289 for those who make more than $100,000 a year. The education divide is even more pronounced. College dropouts spend about $700. People with degrees only spend $178. While the lotteries spend millions promoting their games as harmless entertainment and encouraging people to imagine themselves quitting their jobs and buying mansions. Hey, you never know, reads the New York Lottery's tagline. Studies show that poor players are 25% more likely than richer players to consider a ticket a genuine investment and to vastly overestimate their chances of winning. Ticket sales in 25 state lotteries spiked during the recent recession. They're playing this to try and get back to some status, says Cornell University economist David Just. They say they see this as their best chance of doing so. Are the winners happy? Not always. Winners are often unprepared for the challenges that following getting a big windfall and can find themselves swamped by friends and relatives demanding loans or gifts and financial advisors offering bad investment opportunities. I had to endure the greed and the need that people have trying to get you to release your money to them, says Sandra Hayes, who was one of the several people splitting a $224 million prize in Missouri. Several studies suggest that lottery winners are disproportionately likely to wind up bankrupt. In some cases, winners' lives are completely ruined by their sudden wealth. West Virginia businessman Jack Whitaker was already a millionaire when he won $315 million in 2002. In the years that followed, he was robbed several times, split from his wife, and lost his granddaughter to a drug overdose. "I wish we had torn the ticket up," he said. What do defenders of the lottery say? They argue that a voluntary payment cannot be considered a tax, and that lotteries offer players a chance to escape the humdrum reality of every day. "It's a cheap way to buy a license to fantasize," says George Lowenstein, a professor of economics and psychology at Carnegie Mellon University. But critics charge that while governments usually spend money trying to stop people from escaping reality in self-destructive ways, advising against excessive alcohol consumption, for example, they actively encourage the poor to spend precious money on lotteries. Ultimately, though, lottery income has become such an integral part of states' budgets that lawmakers would consider it political suicide to do anything that will reduce that revenue stream. The problem with lotteries, says state tax expert David Broomey, is that politicians don't view them as a tax. They view them as a victimless source of revenue. Tips on playing Powerball. If you can't resist playing the lotteries despite the long odds, the only way to increase your chance of winning is to buy more tickets. But there's a cheaper way of maximizing the chance you won't have to share the jackpot if you do get lucky. The first trick is to not pick numbers between 1 and 31, as many players choose those to reflect important dates like birthdays and anniversaries. You're just as likely to win with higher numbers. For the same reason, avoid obvious combinations like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Check your ticket thoroughly. An incredible $2 billion worth of prizes went unclaimed last year, including $114 worth $1 million or more. Finally, although all but six of the 44 Powerball states require winners to publicly identify themselves, you can get around that by creating a limited liability company to collect the winnings. Most important of all, time your ticket purchase to maximize the amount of time you spend dreaming of what you want to do with tens of millions of dollars. To get your money's worth, advises economist Alex Tarbagot, buy early in the power cycle to extend the pleasure of anticipation. Now we're moving on to talking points. Barbie, a new chubbier version. Barbie's got a new body, said Elena Doctorman in Time.com. The iconic Mattel doll has undergone a radical makeover in her 57th year and now comes in three new sizes. Actually, tall, petite, and most revolutionary of all, a chunkier version with a plump bottom. Unlike the classic Barbie Maleficent Roberts, who, if scaled up to human size, would have a ridiculous 18-inch waist to go with her busty 5'9", 110-pound frame, the most realistic of the new Barbies has a body equivalent to that of a rather average 5'4", 166-pound woman. She has meat on her thighs and a protruding tummy and comes with a variety of new skin tones and hair textures. It's about time, said Benet Vara of Fusion.net. More than 9 out of 10 American girls have owned a Barbie. Now perhaps those girls will grow up thinking that short is normal, that chubby is normal. This politically correct makeover was said Melanie Notkin in the New York Post. I grew up as a big fan of Barbie and never for one moment thought the doll was supposed to represent me. Barbie represents whomever I wanted her to be, a banker, a doctor, a fashion model. It was all a case of using one's imagination, something that used to be considered vital to kids' development. Besides, Mattel isn't changing Barbie for the girls who play with her, says Susie Boniface in the Mirror, UK. It's doing it for the adults who worry more about the sort of thing, this sort of thing, than children do, out of concern over what message a doll was sending to their daughters. Adults have been buying fewer. Barbie sales plunged 20% between 2012 and 2014. Don't dismiss the impact toys can have on children's expectations, said Megan Garber in the Atlantic.com. Why not make Barbies that give girls broader and more modern expectations of their career options? Shift their view of feminine ideals so that it's not impossibly thin, large-breasted, and white. Obviously, Mattel didn't change Barbie because it wanted to be a moral leader. It did so because the marketplace has sent a clear negative signal about a doll designed for 1950s sensibility. In other words, Barbie's transformation isn't a case of diversity for diversity's sake. In 2006, diversity is much more pragmatically, much more transformatively good business. Well, we've run out of time for today's edition of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Shadate Hargett Hill for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Again, our website is TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any information for us, would like to donate, or have a sponsorship of any of our programs, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.